Russia says it will hit back at the Czech Republic over its expulsion of 18 Russian diplomats on unfounded and absurd grounds. Syrian parliament sets May the 26th for the presidential election, the second such vote since the start of the Western-backed war on Syria in 2011. The Gaza Strip records its highest ever daily toll of coronavirus deaths as the besieged enclave struggles with the shortage of vaccines. Marzia Hashemi, thanks so much for being with us. Well, Russia has pledged to retaliate after the Czech Republic expelled 18 Russian diplomats over a 2014 explosion that killed two people in an eastern Czech town. Moscow called the expulsion a provocation. It said the accusations that Russian intelligence services were behind the blast are absurd and unfounded. Russia said it's hard not to see the American trace. It accused the Czech Republic of striving to please the U.S. Prague says the Russian diplomats have been identified as spies. The U.K. has backed the expulsions. It says Czech officials have exposed the lengths that Russia will go to in its attempt to carry out what London called dangerous and malign operations. The Syrian parliament says the presidential election will take place on May the 26th.
I invite those who wish to run for the position of President of the Syrian Arab Republic to submit their candidacies to the Supreme Constitutional Court within a 10-day period, starting Monday morning, April 19th.
Sabah said Syrians abroad will be able to vote in respective embassies on May the 20th. This is the second presidential election in Syria since the Western-backed insurgency began there in 2011 to overthrow the government. The previous presidential election was held in 2014, in which Bashar al-Assad won 88% of the vote. If reelected, he can stay in office for another seven-year term. Mohammed Ali in Damascus says the upcoming presidential election is very important at this time. Most of Syrian regions are under control of the government.
Those candidates, in order to become presidential candidates, they should also win the approval or votes of at least 35 members of Syria's parliament. The parliamentary elections will happen on the 26th of next month. This is a very important, of course, election because this time most of the Syrian territories are under the control of the Syrian government and the Syrian army, unlike previous elections, in which there were many areas controlled and occupied by terrorist groups. And that fact deprived and blocked many Syrians from taking part in those elections. And we have to point out also that if you ask Syrians on the street, it seems that most of them do actually want to vote for President Bashar al-Assad if he runs. Of course, they have to wait and see, because he is the president who won the majority of of the acceptance of Syrians, because he led this war against terror on Syrians and also led the Syrian army in their victories against all of the terrorist groups that attacked Syria in the past 11 years.
And the Gaza Strip has recorded 23 new deaths from coronavirus in the past 24 hours. That's the highest ever daily toll of virus fatalities there. According to the health ministry, total COVID deaths in Gaza are now 761. The Palestinian enclave had been largely spared by the illness for much of last year, but in August, cases were recorded in its densely populated refugee camps and jumped in recent weeks. That comes as the Israeli blockaded territory struggles with the shortage of COVID vaccines. Gaza has so far received only 80,000 doses for the population of some 2 million. Authorities have imposed a curfew as part of measures to contain the disease. Ashraf Shannon in Gaza says the health system there could collapse soon as only a tiny portion of the population has received COVID vaccines.
a population of 2 million only received 80,000 doses of vaccine, which is enough to inoculate around just 40,000 people. Less than 1% of Gazans have been inoculated, while the Israeli regime that continues to place the blockade on Gaza has inoculated most of the population. Yes, the situation is extremely dangerous, and soon the health system could collapse because of this COVID-19 pandemic that has entered its second wave in early March.
Iran's ambassador to the international organizations in Vienna says the ongoing nuclear talks there are aimed at creating a vivid picture on the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. Qasem Gharibabadi said it is necessary to identify and list the required measures to remove the sanctions. He said the U.S. seriousness in its claims to return to the nuclear deal and its commitments should also be verified. The envoy also noted that the principles outlined by the leader of the Islamic Revolution are the basis for the negotiations by the Iranian team. On Saturday, Iran's chief negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, said a new understanding is being reached, though serious disagreements remain that need to be addressed.
Iran's lead nuclear negotiator in Vienna, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says a new understanding is being reached amid attempts to revive the Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Following a joint commission session with JCPOA signatories, Russia, China, Britain, France and Germany, Araghchi said negotiators can now start working on a common draft.
Drafting can begin at least in the areas where the sides share the same views. For that purpose, the Iranian delegation has prepared its drafts both on the nuclear measures and sanction lifting, and has presented its drafts to the other parties. And we believe these texts can form the basis for negotiations and a final agreement.
Although the nuclear measures that Iran needs to take to come back to full compliance are clear, there is less clarity when it comes to the list of U.S. sanctions that need to be removed.
China maintained that all U.S. sanctions should be lifted immediately. May it concern sanctions against Iran or its long-term jurisdiction measures affecting third country entities and individuals, including those on Chinese. So, we are looking forward to such a drafting exercise.
Iran has remained steadfast in its position that it will only act after verifying the U.S.'s removal of all sanctions, including those imposed additionally or relabeled under former President Donald Trump. Although there have been no direct talks between Iran and the U.S., American delegates in Vienna have been engaged in talks with the EU coordinator and the other JCPOA signatories. Iran's lead delegate says there are still some serious differences that need to be worked out. For now, the expert working groups have been tasked with engaging in more substantive work for the next few days. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Well, Iran is marking its Army Day by staging limited parades involving only military hardware due to the coronavirus pandemic. The event this year mainly focuses on parading military vehicles and showcasing domestically built weapons inside selected army bases across the country. Because of COVID-19, authorities decided to cancel the marches. In Tehran, various types of drones, tanks, anti-aircraft batteries, advanced missile systems, different kinds of electronic warfare systems were put on display. Iran has always maintained that its military might is for defensive purposes. Iranian affairs expert Kadim Shahrarah says the Islamic Republic has boosted its military capabilities despite sanctions imposed on the country.
Iran has never stopped improving on its military capabilities and showcasing its military capabilities. Now, be it COVID or any other times, I mean, Iran has been through even more trying times than this, and has still managed to advance its military capabilities, as you said, its defensive capabilities, so that we are where we are today. I mean, just last year, Iran unveiled its underground ballistic missile sites. I mean, Iran has always improved on this, even though it's been under sanctions for most of its life. I mean, from going from where Iran was to now producing ballistic missiles, precision missiles, and I think it's very telling that even though Iran has been under attack for most of its life, has been on the defensive for most of its life, it's also been able to score so many advances in the region, geopolitically speaking, because the people of the region know that Iran has been on the defensive and that they've been on the defensive against the Western onslaught in the region.
Well, new findings indicate that two decades of war in Afghanistan has killed some 241,000 people, including Afghan civilians as well as American service members. Now, despite the U.S.'s pledge to withdraw from the war-torn country, the Taliban militant group says it is not willing to attend any peace summit aimed at bringing years of conflict to an end. Our correspondent Amin Alami brings us more from Kabul.
America's longest war in Afghanistan is going to end as Washington has pledged to pull out its forces from the country in 5 months. Apart from other consequences of Washington's war in Afghanistan, casualties caused by the conflict over the past two decades showed that almost 90,000 Afghan and U.S. military forces, more than 70,000 civilians, and over 84,000 terrorists have lost their lives since 2001. The main cause behind such casualties is said to be Washington's failures, including taking the Taliban not so seriously. Although weak presence of Taliban was seen in remote villages of Afghanistan in 2001, it slowly expanded its maneuver area to big cities by launching bomb attacks or complex assaults in and after 2005. The attacks mostly claimed the lives of civilians. In response, Afghan and foreign troops launched more military operations, especially air strikes, increasing human losses in the country. Now that Washington has realized there is no military solution to the Afghan war, U.S. President Joe Biden announced on Wednesday that all U.S. troops will leave the war-torn country by September 11, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The Afghan government strongly believes that the Taliban will never be able to take control over the country militarily due to high capabilities of Afghan National Armed Troops in the fight against terrorism.
The Afghan Defense Ministry, in close cooperation with other government bodies, is fully ready to confront the worst-case scenario. Concerns of some international intelligence agencies are because of the security of their own countries. But we are not worried because we are now capable enough to defend our nation.
Meneher also argued that the only way to put an end to bloodshed in Afghanistan is the establishment of a united front by Afghan people without being dependent on foreign players, and convince the Taliban to lay down their arms.
The time has arrived for all Afghans to come together and set aside differences in order to use the ongoing peace process as an opportunity for the country to see peace and stability after decades-long war and violence.
While all players are waiting for the launch of Turkey summit on the Afghan peace process, the Taliban say they are not willing to attend it because the U.S. violated the terms of the agreement signed between the two in Doha, February last year. Based on the Doha agreement, U.S. military forces have to leave Afghanistan by May 1st. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Armed men have killed 19 civilians after raiding a village in West Niger, close to the border with Mali. Municipal officials say two people were wounded in the attack that took place on Saturday evening. The village is located in the Tillaberi region that has regularly been targeted by militants affiliated with the Daesh terror group. In total, at least 300 people have been killed in attacks in West Niger this year. No group has claimed responsibility. Those assaults. Well, Germany holds a national memorial service for its nearly 80,000 victims of the coronavirus. The ceremony in Berlin will be attended by Chancellor Angela Merkel and President Frank-Walter Steinmeier. The ceremony is being held with the attendance of a limited number of people due to the pandemic. Germany is struggling to curb a third wave of the disease, which has hit the nation hard. Germany recorded over 19,000 new infections and 67 deaths over the past 24 hours. Well, Canadians have taken to the streets of the city of Toronto to protest against lockdown measures implemented by the government to curb the coronavirus pandemic. Now, demonstrators chanted slogans and held signs calling for lockdown measures to end. They called the restrictive measures illegal. Protesters also urged authorities to tell people the truth, arguing that they are rather facing a pandemic of fraud. They urge other Canadians to come out to fight for their rights.
Freedom of movement, freedom of speech, freedom of peaceful assembly affects all of us. So we invite everyone to come and join and fight for that.
Now, the protest comes against the backdrop of a steep rise in COVID cases in the country. In Ontario, more than 4,300 new cases were reported on Saturday. Projections indicate the virus could spike to 10,000 per day in June if more strict restrictions are not implemented. Ontario Premier Doug Ford has been under fire for what protesters call his mishandling of the pandemic. He, however, blames the federal government for the spike, saying it had been too slow to wrap up vaccinations. Going south from there to the United States, where an analysis of gun violence from various databases show police killings of individuals continue to go up unabated in the U.S., with the majority of victims being people of color. According to the analysis published by the New York Times, at least 64 people have died at the hands of law enforcement nationwide since March the 29th. That's the day when testimony began in the case against a former Minneapolis police officer charged with the killing of George Floyd. Black and Latinos represent more than half of those people killed, with an average of more than three victims a day. The killing of 13-year-old Latino, made public just recently, sparked anger against police brutality. Meanwhile, fresh demonstrations have been held in the cities of Minneapolis, Chicago, and Portland against racial killings. And with that, it brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-3. 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Proper Nutrition with Brother Sayyid Vahid Alavi in the program The Month of Allah.
Assalamu alaikum everyone and welcome back to The Month of Allah. In the last program we tried to answer the question how to eat. And we answered it, but I'm going to go through it one more time in this program. In this program, we're going to talk about another question. And that is, how many meals a day does Islam recommend us to eat? How many meals should we eat during the day? I will mention some narrations about the meals. In one narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, eat breakfast and dinner and do not eat anything between those two because it causes the destruction of the body. Have you not heard, the Imam is referring to a verse of the Noble Quran, he says, have you not heard that the Lord says, and they, the dwellers of paradise, have their special sustenance in the mornings and in the evenings. From another narration of Imam Ridha alayhi salam, he says, that a person should eat twice a day, once in the beginning of the day and once in the beginning of the evening. In another narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, which was addressed to a person who complained of stomach pain, the Imam tells him, eat only at the beginning of the day and at the beginning of the night. Therefore, in contrast of the habit that we have, that we eat lunch, you know, we eat lunch, everyone eats lunch. You go after your work and eat lunch with your colleagues, you eat lunch in school, you eat lunch in the university, and so on and so forth. The narrations say that you should not eat lunch and eat breakfast and dinner. So what is concluded from the narrations is that a Muslim, if a Muslim wants to follow the Muslim lifestyle, should eat twice a day, in the morning and in the evening, and jump over the lunch. But what should a person do if, for example, I feel hunger between those two meals? What should I do then? Well, the recommendation is that you should eat fruits and eat a lot of it. And that is something that we can do during Ramadan too. In the holy month of Ramadan, instead of eating breakfast and dinner, what do? We eat sahari and iftar. And iftar means break fast or breaking the fast. And sahari means to keep vigil or to wake. And that means to wake up early so you will be able to eat. And that again is recommended twice a day, your sahari and your iftari. What we can conclude from these narrations is that appetite and hunger are linked together. And the human well-being is linked to those two, that you should feel appetite and you should feel hunger when you want to eat. And still feel a small appetite is left, but you stop eating there. So the human well-being is in those two key factors. Imam Ali alayhi salam tells his son, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, four recommendations that if you do not want to visit a doctor, if you don't want to feel any need for a doctor, you should follow those four recommendations. Number one, to feel truly hunger and then and only then start eating. So feel hunger when you want to eat. Number two, to stop eating when you still have some appetite left. Number three, do not swallow until the food is thoroughly chewed. And number four, to visit the toilet and relieve yourself before sleeping. And in the next coming programs, inshallah ta'ala, I will talk more about the different meals and when to eat those different meals, inshallah ta'ala. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. Ramadan Kareem.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we saw that more than 50 countries have depleted uranium weapons. These weapons have been used extensively by U.S. and NATO forces during the past three decades, namely in Iraq and the Balkans. The consequences for both military personnel and civilians have proven to be tragic. Yet despite the evidence, the military industry and nuclear authorities continue to downplay the dangers. Don't go away, here's the rest of the program.
Our soldiers on peace missions in the Balkans are said to have been contaminated due to the presence of depleted uranium in the munitions.
My friends, we have with us Sergeant Major Antonacci. Unfortunately, you're ill. Could you tell us how this came about?
I left on August the 31st, 1998, for a six-month mission. I got the go-ahead after medical checks. During my stay in Sarajevo, I suffered several faint and dizzy spells. And a few months after I came back, these were attributed to lymphoma.
Cancer?
In Florence, I meet General Fabio Mini. In 2002, he takes command of the NATO mission in Kosovo. He's immediately concerned by the risks involved with depleted uranium, following NATO strikes in the area in 1999.
My chain of command, formed by an American admiral in Naples and the supreme Allied commander in Brussels, stood by the official directives and reports, including those drawn up by scientists in the US. I was therefore frequently confronted with this type of response. It's true, Fabio. You're right to be worried, but we have reports which say that there's no problem. And from a military point of view, we can't bypass them to do things that go beyond what is asked of us.
and which could even prevent us from accomplishing our mission. So it was recommended that we reiterate and support among the civil population the fact that it wasn't a grave danger, that it was quite normal, and to say to the military, especially the engineer corps, treat the depleted uranium munitions like any other type of munitions. But a grenade is not the same thing as a depleted uranium projectile. I'll tell you something. In 2007, I was treated for a tumor in my colon. I never wondered if it was because of the year I spent in Kosovo. But I'll always have doubts. I still have a doubt today that it was perhaps due to that.
Politicians in Rome are mobilized, as is the government. For the first time, without waiting for definitive scientific confirmation, a law recognizes the danger of depleted uranium. When Arturo Parisi is appointed Minister of Defense in 2006, the case is one of his first preoccupations.
Our concern is that the suffering, the pain, the injuries, deaths, and damage should never go beyond, by even a millimeter, what has been foreseen in some way. The problem with depleted uranium, and this was what worried us, is that not only does it produce negative effects, as in the military sector almost everything produces negative effects, but also that it produces uncontrollable effects, which go beyond the present. That's the problem with depleted uranium. So from this point of view, something that might appear not too costly could, on the contrary, with time, become very costly.
Here we have a depleted uranium shell. Its radioactivity level is 40% less than what we can find here in this room.
The Atlantic Alliance is slow to acknowledge the use of depleted uranium weapons in the Balkans. In 2001, an official report estimates the quantities used at more than 3 tons in Bosnia and 10 tons in Kosovo. But NATO command refuses to confirm any link whatsoever between its airstrikes and any contamination. When I contacted the Allied Forces Communications Agency in Brussels, nobody was willing to answer my questions. In France, Alain Acariès is an inconsolable father. His son died in 1997 from lymph gland cancer. Ludovic was a soldier driving a truck in Bosnia. A truck that was contaminated, claims Alain Acariès, by depleted uranium dust since the Gulf War. He had his suspicions confirmed by an independent laboratory.
Mr. Acariès provided them with several samples of his son's cancerous lymph glands taken in a French hospital after his death. A powerful electronic microscope and a new technique perfected by Professor Gatti revealed the interior of the tissue.
We can clearly see the tiny particles, nanoparticles. They're not degradable nor compatible. They're not compatible with life.
Even more surprising is the chemical composition of these nanoparticles.
There is silver, chlorine, gold, magnesium, and silicon, which form a very strange material that doesn't exist in nature.
You've been working on this case for 11 years, and you've taken legal action. What's the situation today?
Despite what was revealed by the examination, the link with depleted uranium has been denied.
But why are you doing all this?
I want the truth to be acknowledged. I want people to accept that my son was contaminated through the fault of the army, which didn't decontaminate the trucks in the Gulf. Something has to be done. We can't just let it slide. It's been the biggest tragedy in my life.
An association, Avigolf, of which Alain Acariès is a member, has been formed to inform potential depleted uranium victims, most of whom are soldiers, and to support them in their legal battles for justice. I met the magistrate in charge of the affairs filed with the county court in Paris. But the judge, Berthelot Geoffroy, is naturally subject to rules of confidentiality. Despite the slow legal progress, Alain Acariès is still hopeful of winning the case he has lodged. Against him, the military institution remains rooted in its own convictions.
We're not unfamiliar with the debate, and we're taking it into account. But quite simply, we can observe that until now, no study, and God knows many studies have been carried out through the United Nations Environmental Programme, the World Health Organization, or by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and no study has highlighted or demonstrated any long-term harmful consequences on health or on the environment.
Are there any operational theatres where France has intervened recently where these depleted uranium weapons have been used?
No, these weapons haven't been used by France in any operational theatres. I would remind you that depleted uranium munitions are conventional weapons and recognized as such by every international convention. They're not nuclear weapons, which the word uranium could suggest.
France's position is in contradiction with efforts undertaken by the European Parliament. For years, European deputies have been calling for a moratorium on the manufacture and use of these weapons, with MEPs voting such resolutions almost unanimously. Monica Frassoni is co-president of the European Green Party.
The ongoing story began with strange events during the Gulf War, then continued and intensified with the war in Yugoslavia, and it became an almost traditional theme for the European Parliament. One important element, in my view, is that France and the UK have always refused to enforce bans and to support the moratorium on depleted uranium. Very often, we can see the extreme reticence of governments and armies, even of political forces, to raise the subject in public.
The urgent need for more concerted political action against depleted uranium is only more apparent when a new war breaks out, exposing new risks. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq. In 2003, the United States attack Iraq to oust Saddam Hussein, who continues to taunt the US despite 12 years of rigorous sanctions. At the time, I'm in Baghdad, witnessing the repeated air attacks targeting the presidential palaces with depleted uranium projectiles. It's a short-lived war. In just 3 weeks, the Americans removed the dictator. Jim McDermott is not a typical American congressman. He's one of the few who have seen war close up. As an officer, he served in Vietnam, and as a psychiatrist, he has treated some of those who survived.
When I was dealing,
Bush lied, because I went over to Iraq and became Baghdad Jim, not by intention, but because I was there, and they asked me what I thought, and I said, I think he's going to mislead us to get us into war. And so then we did it to all the rest of the country. I mean, and Fallujah was the Basra of 91. Fallujah was where we used absolutely awesome power to destroy that city.
In 2004, the Americans are confronted with massive insurrection. The epicenter is Fallujah. To stem the revolt, the city is bombarded. A deluge of fire rains down with white phosphorus and depleted uranium munitions. Today, peace has been restored to the city of mosques. and life has returned under the watchful eye of the Iraqi army. At the new hospital, Dr. Samira Alan shows me the tragedy she has to face every day.
They born prematurely, and before they complete their pregnancy, just less than 8 months. And one of them born with cleft lip and palate.
These babies will have surgery, right?
Of course, if he
survives.
If he survives, yes.
Yeah.
Since 2006, we start to notice that there is an abnormal increase in the incidence of congenital anomalies among the birth in our hospital. According to the cases we register, the incidence is about 14.7 per 1,000 live birth.
What would be a normal rate of deficiency?
It should not exceed 1 or 2 per 1,000. We examined 25 families from Fallujah. Those families have babies born with birth defects. We took hair sample from the kids and from their parents, and we sent these samples to an independent lab in Germany, and we found high concentration of uranium, mercury, bismuth, and other trace elements that is not usually used by human being and not naturally present in the soil or in the plants.
In Baghdad, the authorities have to take their religious leaders' opinions into account. Their voices carry weight, and their criticism is widely heard. Jawad al-Halisi is the heir to a very influential dynasty, and he protests strongly against what he sees as an attack on his people's genetic integrity.
These deformed children are the result of the use of depleted uranium. They're deformed fetuses. An international effort is required to clean up. In the same way, they brought together 30 countries and their armies under the pretext of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They should work together on a cleansing project, like with the Marshall Plan in Germany, because the sanitary situation in Iraq is catastrophic.
Unlike after the Gulf War of 1991, the U.S. Defense Department has never published figures concerning the use of depleted uranium during the war in Iraq in 2003. Unofficial estimates speak of over 2,000 tons. Since the beginning of my investigation, I've been trying to obtain a reaction from the Pentagon. After weeks of exchanging emails, a spokesman finally responds. Dear sir, we won't be able to accommodate your on-camera interview request. The scientific community have investigated the radiological safety and environmental impacts of depleted uranium for several decades. The Agency for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that it is aware of no cancers or cases of leukemia among workers or other populations that can be attributed to exposure to natural or depleted uranium. In Washington, Time magazine called Thomas Pickering the five-star general of the diplomatic corps. He was actively involved in the international mobilization against Saddam Hussein in 2001, but he openly opposed the war in 2003.
Iraqis who say, look, we came in and created a mess and we didn't resolve it all, in my view, have some justification for their position. I leave it to wise men, lawyers, and judges to tell you whether the answer to the Iraqi is we still owe them more. But if I were an Iraqi, I suppose they would say, yeah, you've got to create a perfect paradise here.
I can understand from an armament standpoint and from strategic planning standpoint why you'd want to have the hardest and the best weapons that could just demolish anything. they're unwilling to look at the aftermath of it and what the Geneva Convention and other things say about, you know, what you leave on the ground afterward. The military is not very well known for its ability to clean up after itself.
The official reluctance to consider the sanitary and environmental impact of depleted uranium can also be explained by economic reasons.
Obviously, from the Army's point of view, and technically, if I have to make a hole in a tank, depleted uranium is great, because it's really effective, and it's recyclable, too. I think in that situation there's little to be said.
It's a win-win situation.
Yes, but just one detail. In Serbia, they saw that to clean one 30-millimeter head from shells that were fired, just to clean where they landed, they spent $300,000, more or less. It might be a win-win situation, but if I have to clean up afterwards...
It's a very expensive win-win situation.
Exactly, for the authorities. And those are figures that have been acknowledged and quoted.
The cost of cleaning up a zone contaminated by depleted uranium dust makes it hard to envisage that the battlefields will one day be rehabilitated. And there's worse. The depleted uranium producing countries like the US and France have to deal with the accumulation of increasingly vast stocks. More than 700,000 tons in the US, almost 200,000 tons in France. Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to the US Energy Department, has been sounding the alarm bells for a number of years.
What we are dealing with, in a certain respect, is what I call national sacrifice zones, that we, in order to amass nuclear weapons in this country, we created very large, profound areas of contamination where we simply lack the capability and the technology to restore them to their original conditions, much less to conditions that would allow even limited uses. So these are areas that we more or less have to sacrifice in the name of nuclear deterrence.
It is by chance that I make an astonishing discovery in Iraq, which confirms Robert Alvarez's alarmist prediction. Close to Basra Airport, the broken shells of tanks destroyed in 2003 are lined up along the road. Soldiers tell me of incidents previously kept secret.
The tanks were contaminated by uranium. A team from the Environment Ministry examined them, and they confirmed the contamination. From time to time, the Americans and the British come here, and they take tanks away somewhere, transporting them further away from the airport. But we don't know what becomes of them.
But I want to know. For the contaminated scrap metal, this mysterious destination is the end of the road, and finding it would mean the end of my investigation. I decide to speak to General Jabbar, who commands the border police in the Basra region.
Some of the scrap was moved to this desert place. How do you call it?
It's called Afra El Batin.
When was it moved there?
The program was set up in 2008. To this provisional site, they transported 150 tons of scrap metal.
What happened to the scrap? When it gets there, when they bring it there, then they put it in the ground, what do they do with the scrap?
They dig and they put it in holes in the ground. They simply take it from one place to another. Obviously, it's in the desert. But according to our information, there are water tables below. Scientific reports say it's potentially dangerous for the water.
I do my utmost to get to Afra El Batin. I need an authorization and an escort. General Jabbar promises to help. But then a counter-order arrives from Baghdad. The affair is beyond his authority, and only a minister can give me the required permission. I know Iraq too well. It will never happen.
one of the things you learn as a child is clean up your own mess. Don't expect somebody else to come in here and pick up your crayons and your toys. So we did this war of choice, and my view is that we have a responsibility for the mess we leave. We can't walk away and just say, well, we don't care.
The depleted uranium question, like any question involving armies, weapons and wars, suffers from a lack of transparency, from a lack of precise democratic control on both national and European levels. I think the priority is to continue the fight on the UN level, which is very useful, and also within the European Union, so that we can obtain a moratorium on depleted uranium munitions.
Countries that have used depleted uranium weapons, quite obviously, are not interested in being raked over the coals for a weapon system they feel they have a right to use and which they feel is not dangerous. But we will see. The international community doesn't stand still on these kinds of things. And I think that if there's an increasing effort to say, look, here are the damages, and you have to have something concrete, and you have to say that this is more than a supposition, and that we have done some research, and unfortunately you have to bring examples of where beyond the pure use of depleted uranium as a tank buster, you have created a special kind of damage to the individuals beyond what normally conventional weapons create, then I think you have a basis for moving ahead.
Depleted uranium munitions were invented in the 1970s to combat Moscow's armored divisions. The Soviet enemy has disappeared, but this all-powerful arsenal has remained. Those responsible for authorizing its use will one day have to be accountable to the victims and explain why they turned a deaf ear to every appeal for caution.
The most brave people are the people who've never been to war. The ones who think war is such a great deal and want to go to the parades and stand there and see the flags go by near the bands. They haven't been anywhere near what it's like when they come.
That's it for this week's episode, and don't forget to share your thoughts and comments with us. Until next week and another Aperture. Goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.